everyone. It's Thursday, February 13th. You're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We woke up to snow this morning in the great state of New Hampshire. I always do the weather report, but I want to remind you that we are beginning every show, every single show, between now and the November election with the voice of Colonel Vindman when he testified before Congress. And another reason why I am so glad that I want you to remember Vindman is that I have a ABC News headline, Trump suggests military should consider disciplinary action against Vindman. Subtitle, Trump fired Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, a key witness to the impeachment inquiry on Friday. And I just want everyone to remember this, remember this. Listen to his words to his father. It will be okay. No, it won't. When we have a tyrant in chief who, frankly, is a traitor to our country, understand that that is who is in the White House. Please listen to the words of Colonel Vindman. He told his father it will be okay. It won't be okay until we replace Donald Trump.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Worry, everyone. Worry, everyone. He is not going to be okay for telling the truth. And just to let you know, John Kelly just defended Alexander Vindman and the media. So, people are finally stepping up. I want to know where every single Republican U.S. senator is. I want to hear their voices. Otherwise, they're aiding and abetting the tyrant in chief, and they are basically selling us out as a nation. I wrote on Facebook today, define what a traitor sounds like. Let me introduce you to members of the United States Senate that happened to have an R next to their name. When you aid and abet Donald Trump and you allow him to do what he is doing with Roger Stone, now with Vindman, all these things he's doing, he's putting his finger on the scales of justice with Roger Stone, what he's doing with Vindman and everything else he has done. Tell me you recognize something called the presidency. It is no longer that. It is the Soviet Union. Anyway, so your thoughts before we go on, Ken, because I want to grab Glenn Smith from Texas because we have so much to talk about as the Houston mayor endorses Mayor Bloomberg tonight, just to let you know.
Right. I used to work for the Department of Justice in the Reagan administration. I started in the Carter administration, mm-hmm. but when Reagan became president, very similar kind of thumb on the scale, thumb from the White House talking to the Attorney General
right.
who told the various lawyers what to do. It was not as ugly as the current
President.
Administration is doing, but it was pretty darn ugly. I was in the Civil Rights Division and they forced lawyers to go into court asking the court to undo consent decrees and desegregation plans, which indeed their predecessors in the Civil Rights Division had gone to court and asked the court to impose in order to desegregate the racist schools in the South.
We need to have these history lessons. That's really important, Ken.
Yeah. So I just want to say it's not like the first time that this has happened. This is clearly as ugly as it gets. There were plenty of career lawyers who quit then, and there were plenty of career lawyers who stuck around for as long as they could take it in order to keep their fingers in the dike and right. try to minimize the amount of
the
cutback,
damage.
Try to maintain
right.
enough of the civil rights enforcement and other kinds of enforcement. I knew people who were in OSHA and people who were in EPA and all the other agencies that Reagan was trying to reverse. And, yeah. you know, it's just like Trump. Today, the people are still in the government. They're trying to do the right thing.
Did you see he suspended the pay raises for all the federal workers? This was supposed to be introduced, and he said, we don't have the finances. You know, he's worried about this. By the way, I thought this was the greatest economy ever. What happened to the revenues coming into our coffers? Well, obviously, we know what happened to the revenues because he cut taxes on corporations. He cut taxes on billionaires.
Yeah.
And as a result, we've got deficits bleeding everywhere. And now what is he doing? He's trying to drive out federal workers.
Yeah, he's trying to drive out the career people who actually care about doing the right thing, having the government do its job. He said we didn't have enough money, but he raises the amount of money that goes to ICE in order to deport people.
Or build a wall.
The money that goes to Border Patrol in order to send people back to Mexico.
Right. I know.
He told the people that were fleeing for their lives from Central America, we don't have enough room in the United States for you.
Right.
Really?
And now he's expanding the public charge rule. I mean, it is mind-blowing.
No, but I mean, it's the same thing. We don't have enough money for you. We have enough money for...
Well, what about the new nukes?
But
the new nukes that we're building, remember? And now we have a space force in the with the military. So it isn't about money. It's about where you direct the dollars.
Right.
You know that.
And one last thing is, for the media's sake, please, media, stop reporting what the administration says as if it were the truth.
Right.
And at least look a little bit below to find out that they're just – it's like selling soap on TV with the ads. It's just phony baloney.
It is phony. It's terrible. All right, everyone. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude. We're going to be joined right now as we go grab him, Glenn Smith. So this has been a very big Texas week. We had Scott Braddock, the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps, in our studio because he came out to experience the New Hampshire primary on Monday and Tuesday and was with us in studio on Wednesday. I recommend, once again, listening to Wednesday's show. It was phenomenal, especially the second half. We spent a lot of time talking about Michael Bloomberg, who apparently has been endorsed by the Houston mayor and will be in Houston tonight. So for my KPFT audience, we'll be talking with Glenn Smith, also of Texas. He's an author, activist, and political consultant. He is currently a senior strategist at Progress Texas. And I sent him a whole series of articles about Texas and the presidential campaign, about Texas and oil and gas. And I just realized that Texas really is our future. And if there is the potential to change Texas politics more than any time in our history, our collective history, Texas needs to go purple, if not blue. If Texas changes, the country changes. And I think what's so scary about Michael Bloomberg is he knows that the Texas Democratic Party has not had enough resources to really sort of take on the GOP, which has been in control for such a long period of time. And my fear about Bloomberg is not a problem. I'll help you revive the Democratic Party in Texas. But for what point? So that we can get the benevolent despot Bloomberg in over the destructive despot, a fellow by the name of Donald Trump, out. But joining us right now on the line is Glenn Smith. Welcome to the program, Glenn. How are you?
Always great to be here. How you doing?
I guess I'm all right. What can I say? Before we get into, we have a whole series of articles, but are you surprised that the Houston, Texas mayor is endorsing Michael Bloomberg, which will be happening tonight? Obviously, Bloomberg is coming into Texas. He began his campaign with his bus tour in Texas. He's been writing checks for Democratic parties all over the country. If there's a party that needs his resources, it's obviously the Texas Democratic Party. But can you sort of go through the tea leaves and explain to me what's going on with Houston?
Well, I'm not quite as cynical as to attribute support to Bloomberg simply for the money he's spending, which is extraordinary here, by the way, and almost immeasurable at the moment. But I'm going to kind of make a larger point, and whether they're right or wrong, and to generalize about a single demographic is always dangerous, but I'm going to do it anyway. I think African-Americans around the country know more deeply in their bones than maybe some of the rest of us what a second Trump term could do to them.
I hear that.
And I think they are making a judgment, right or wrong, on what candidate is the best chance of beating Trump. I don't believe it's the money. The support has come over too quickly in places that he hadn't even spent money yet. So it could be wrong.
Well, let me just say something. I agree with you. I think if it's a choice between Bloomberg's record on stop and frisk or another term of Donald Trump, they will forgive him for stop and frisk because so many people were embracing stop and frisk, including some members of the African-American community. I mean, let's be honest. It wasn't just – I mean, they began to realize the consequences of stop and frisk. And the good news is he had to come to – I guess you can't say come to Jesus when you're a Jew. But he did change his position on stop and frisk in 2020. So I think they're looking at his past. They're hearing this, apologia. And they're also looking at the fact that Donald Trump – will be not only a disaster for their community, but he will be a disaster for the planet.
Well, there was I can't tell you the names of the participants. It was a private meeting, but there was a meeting with African-American pastors from around the country in New York. And they don't take it lightly. From the reports I had from my friends, and some of these were people that had organized bus trips around the country in the 2000s with me, et cetera. They're challenging him on that.
Yes.
But they're also leaving room for forgiveness and
right.
and for his change of heart on it. So, I mean, I would look at this one way, whatever you think of Bloomberg, and talk about that more generally, but I think it's the way politics is supposed to work,
Right. And understand that I think he's an earworm in Donald Trump's head. He knows he's the real billionaire versus the faux billionaire. He knows that Democrats are exhausted and they want anything but Trump. And what Bloomberg does is says, not a problem. I'll pay for this. I'll take care of this. I know every skeleton in Donald Trump's closet because I'm from New York, too. I mean, there's a lot of reasons to talk about Michael Bloomberg. In fact, he has given, I won't even tell you how many hundreds of mayors support and money. The mayor's school at Harvard is something he funds. So there are a lot of mayors that have historic relationship. He helped them on guns. He helped, fight coal. He's good on climate change. Look, there's virtue to Mayor Bloomberg. The problem then becomes, it really is, but for the billions he will spend, and I believe he'll end up spending billions, not millions, but billions on this campaign. It also sort of reflects what has happened to democracy in America. It really is a money sport as much as it is a electoral sport.
Oh, that's so true, Arnie. I mean, I agree that it is emblematic of that. And we got to have wholesale campaign finance reform in the wake of Citizens United, which just exacerbated a problem that was already growing to almost unimaginable degrees. I sound like I'm like pitching Bloomberg. I'm really not. One of the things I don't like about his sudden rise is that Klobuchar, who I really do like, is really coming to her own. And I'm excited to see how she performs in Texas. She really hasn't been here yet and hadn't made any contacts here yet. And I suppose she's focusing on Nevada and South Carolina.
Well, she must. She has no ground game. She has no campaign except for the fact that she performed well in that last debate, was able, as people were trying to figure out, and saw Elizabeth Warren tanking. And I think really she became the alternative for a lot of people. And they saw that during the debate. But I will tell you right now, she had no ground game in Iowa, no ground game in New Hampshire. So you have to ask about political skills, which are also organizational skills. So the fact that, you perform well in a debate is fine, but in the end, if you don't know how to get out the vote, then you won't succeed.
Yeah, let me tell you, may not work against her in Texas, which is so darn big that nobody's going to have much of a ground game.
Yeah.
I mean, an effective ground game, right?
Right.
It's like, to have an effective ground game here really does cost millions and millions of dollars. It's one reason Democrats have had a hard time struggling back, because it's hard to reach our voters in a persistent way because it's so costly. So we'll see.
So I want to segue into Texas and the Democratic candidates and Democratic politics. So one of the things that I was hearing after the Iowa debacle with the caucus was that maybe Iowa won't go first. And a lot of environmentalists were waxing poetic because that means, oh, God, we can get rid of biofuels. They don't work anyway. All right. And the only reason why we have biofuels is that people have been genuflecting to the Iowa community forever. And as a result, because of ethanol and all those other things, it has been sort of front and center because you had to say it in order to sort of court votes in Iowa. I saw a piece at the Houston Chronicle, and I really wanted to talk a little bit about it. It was entitled, "In Democratic Primary, Fossil Fuel Bans Rule Even for Centrists." And why I'm going to ask this question of you, Glenn, is that in the article, there was a segment that I want to just read one paragraph to you and ask me whether this is real or Memorex. It says, making a case, Environmentalists believe that the Democratic Party has finally turned a corner, willing to take drastic action on climate change. Oil and gas lobbyists, however, view the bans as typical campaign pledges in a competitive Democratic primary, like to be softened or disappeared altogether ahead of November's general election. Now that they're willing to count on that, they're preparing to make the case to the eventual Democratic nominee that the economic disruption caused by scaling back drilling would far outweigh the environmental benefits. So are my Democratic candidates lying to me about oil and gas? And will they be tested in Texas? And will they soften and sell out to oil and gas? I'm curious whether the article is actually representative of what you see as well.
Well, that's a good question. And I'm going to answer it this way. No, they're not lying, but they may be overpromising because of the political power of the energy industry nationwide and its stroke in Congress.
The lying oil and gas industry that lied to us about climate change, even though they knew it, and now have produced the results. I just want to remind you, I understand the virtue of their jobs. I understand the virtue of their money and their power, but also understand they have been lying to us for a long time, and now they want to hold on to the jobs as they sacrifice the climate.
That's true. The point I want to make is I think the global economy is going to take them down faster than politicians can.
I agree.
In the real world.
I agree.
And there's another column yesterday in the Houston Chronicle by a very, very smart writer named Chris Tomlinson. And he points out that the virus in China, the coronavirus in China, has already reduced demand for oil and gas products globally 2%.
Mm-hmm.
The market's already glutted. So mm-hmm. we talk about like the oil and gas production and fracking here in Texas. They're swimming in it now. They can't sell it. They can't get it to market. And as he points out, that's a harbinger of things to come because
yes.
globally everybody is scaling back their demand.
Right.
Whatever else is happening by restricting oil and gas drilling and exploration, nations across the globe are reducing their demand for the product.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's going to take care of it faster than politicians anywhere
mm-hmm.
can act to reduce it. I hope they try. I'm with you on that. I think the economy is going to take care of this as fast as anything.
Well, you know, it's really interesting you say that because you know what this reminds me of? The conversation we're having right now is the conversation they're having in Australia. Because Australia is the greatest exporter of coal. And yet Australia is burning. And they are living the consequence of climate change in a way that is so damn intense. And so all of a sudden, they realize that coal has been their job creator. They get it. They understand how much of the economy has been driven by coal. They also realize that coal is one of the greatest contributors to climate change, and now they are dying and burning and losing a billion animals. And so the question, and here's the question they have, which is exactly what oil and gas is going to say to the Democratic nominees once they get the nomination, is, you know, well, what about the jobs? What about this? And the problem is, well, we'll let someone else take care of it. We'll continue to do it, but I'm sure they'll deal with it in Europe. I'm sure they'll deal with it in India. You know, it's not our job, which is what the Australians are saying. We'll still have climate change if we stop producing coal, so why should we stop producing coal? We'll still have climate change even if we stop producing oil, coal, and gas or fracking in the United States, so why should we do it? And that's part of the problem, I think, Glenn, is that everybody has an excuse waiting for someone else, and that's the way that they continue to produce the particles and the contribution to this, you know, crazy climate change we're living in. And then instead, nobody resolves it, even as you say, you know, if I'm going to depend on coronavirus, God help us.
No, that's just a harbinger. You're not depending upon it.
I know.
I'm making the follow-up point. There's two things to do. Is to hold the politician accountable. I'm not saying back off that or speak like the speaker in Australia. I'm saying let's don't put too much faith in them, but let's keep the pressure on.
Right.
It's an emergency.
It is an emergency.
I agree with that totally. I also agree that all of us should radically, dramatically reduce what we're contributing to demand.
Yeah.
And because I know that they got to respond to that. And if we want to move them into renewables faster, the way to do it is not buy their oil and gas products. Let's get out of our cars, right? Let's walk more. Let's take the buses more. In the Sun Belt, we don't even have mass transportation much to speak of. We're a car-based economy, and we got to stop it.
Yeah.
And I think that's a faster way to transition to, you know, to renewables. Not to take the political pressure off. I don't mean that
right,
at all.
Right.
I just mean, let's be realistic.
I mean, I hate to say this. I'll buy them. I'll buy the oil, coal, and gas industry. We can buy nukes. We have trillions of dollars in the military-industrial complex. And no, I'm dead serious. If you don't, if you want to continue to exist, I'll buy you. I'll buy you out. And as I buy you out, I mean, if you look at the Green New Deal, there's transition for all those workers. I get it. But if that's what it takes, I mean, that's what's so remarkable to me. We are so worried about national security. Donald Trump is adding more and more money to the Pentagon budget. They don't even know how much money they have. They can't even follow their dollars. And in the end, what is national security? It's not just an atomic bomb now. It's an atomic climate. And if that's the case, I'll cut you a check. You know, money buys a lot. I'm waiting for someone to say this. This should be part of the Green New Deal. Don't just shut down a coal plant, buy it out. Don't just shut down an oil field, buy it out. Say to them, okay, I'll cut the check. You can then desire to disappear to Aruba with all your billions, but don't kill us in the process.
I'm with you.
All right. All right. So talk to me a little bit again about what's happening with the Democrats on the ground. We know Bloomberg is coming in, but I saw another story. I believe it was at the Houston Chronicle. And the other story at the Houston Chronicle was the idea that national money is flowing into Texas for 2020 Democrats. Now, is national money only Bloomberg money, or are we really seeing other dollars showing up here? Because people realize that if they do flip Texas, which we began to get a sense that we might be able to do because of what Beto was able to do against Texas, Ted Cruz, are people waking up and smelling the coffee that if you reinforce the potential for Democrats in Texas, you really do change the country forever?
Yes. We have, even before Bloomberg announced that he might run, national organizations and donors were contributing more to Texas than they have any year in the last quarter century. They did pretty well in our state house races in 2018, I have to say. Because we've never really seen anything like it. Mostly what national Democrats have done is come to Texas and taken money from our donors and spent it elsewhere.
Yes, exactly.
And that's turned around. And because we're 9 seats from taking the state house, and it's a doable deal given the changing population centers of Texas.
Right.
So, yes, they're spending money on it. It's pretty well organized. The infrastructure's in better shape than it's ever been, in my opinion, and I've been at this more years than I'm going to tell you.
I know. Ann Richards, go back. How many decades is that now?
It seems like only yesterday.
I know.
There's something I want to mention that relates to both these last two questions, and there's another story about the growth of population along the Interstate 35 corridor in Texas.
Right, I have that up.
It's a more progressive population that's filling in that I don't know what you call it, might be blue stripe from the south to the north of Texas.
Right. I have the monthly right in front of me. The booming suburbs of Dallas, Austin, and San Antonio could change the distribution of power in the state. Continue.
Now, I want to tell you how I can be cynical about some things, because there has been a really reasonably modest proposal that people have been working on for a high-speed rail along that corridor, and the Republicans have all but killed it. It's still alive as a dream, but I've never figured out why the Republicans were so against rail. Well, one is they take a lot of money from the oil and gas industry, and they make gas and they put it in cars, so
right,
why give
exactly,
an alternative? But
exactly.
Another one is they know where this population growth is going to happen before it happens. And why facilitate it with a high-speed rail that will reduce commuter time and boost the economy for voters they don't want here?
Exactly. And you know, I'm a kid from New York. You'll love this, Glenn. So I grew up on Long Island. And Long Island understood that the most important thing they could do was the Long Island Railroad. And the Long Island Railroad made it possible for people to live out in Suffolk County, like out into the middle of the ocean in Ronkonkoma, to be able to go into the city conveniently and easily. And the Long Island Railroad changed the nature of Long Island because it connected it into the places where the jobs were in the city. It made the suburbs robust, and nobody wanted to drive because it was a parking lot to drive into the city. And so
That's
the
right.
importance of rail, you see it in places like Minneapolis and St. Paul. You see it on the Long Island Railroad. I mean, just to give you one thing, I mean, rail is so important. This one, I remember when I went from Hicksville, which is where I was raised, straight into the airport. Literally, they created a whole new line straight into the airport. And the conductor said at the beginning, I thought, how stupid was this? And he goes, now, a year later, it was the brilliant, brilliant idea. It changed the nature of commuting on Long Island because I could access the airport. So again, the idea of rail is crucial. It will change Texas. But guess what? It is the best thing for Texas economy as well.
No, it's happening. You know, we have a transportation plan underway here in Central Texas that does many of those things you just mentioned, because it's crucial to connect those suburbs to
right.
the inner cities where the jobs are.
Right.
Or people aren't going to be able to get to their jobs.
Right.
Right. And among other things, we're forcing the sort of middle class workers who take care of the buildings and the restaurants, et cetera, in the inner city. They have to live so far away that they can't make it here for
right.
jobs.
So you don't have the worker bees, and you're not going to – I mean, it's so foolish on everyone's part, because you need to clean those buildings in order that people can make money in those buildings. We're so interconnected.
So they're going to – I think that's underway here. There's going to be a vote in November on that, and it's one of those really forward – instead of doing it piecemeal, they're going to do it from 100 years back. They're looking like, what's the demand far out in the future, and build it.
I love it.
To meet that demand so they don't have to make a change or go to different bonds every other week.
Well, Glenn Smith, author, activist, and political consultant, senior strategist at Progress Texas. I just want to remind you, he managed Ann Richards' campaign in the 1990 primary victory. We are talking decades here. God, the two of us are so old in the tooth, Glenn. Thank you so much for joining us. I hope someday to meet you and keep you and Scott Braddock in my pocket, because I know Texas is so important, and you're both of the best teachers. So thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on. I really enjoy doing it.
All right. Take care. Ciao. Bye-bye. All right, everyone. A little labor history is next. This is The Attitude with Artie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. What labor union would you say has the coolest name? The Sons of Vulcan would most certainly have to be in the running. And on this day in labor history, the year was 1865. That was the day the Sons of Vulcan ended their 8-month strike and won a union contract. The Vulcans were skilled steelworkers. Many were immigrants from England, Scotland, and Wales. They worked at puddling, the process by which carbon was burnt off of molten iron in order to form steel. It was tough work that required physical strength, skill, and experience. The Vulcans first formed in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in 1858. A skilled trade union, only puddlers were eligible to join. They called their locals forges. They took their name, Vulcan, from the Roman god of fire and volcanoes. With the ongoing Civil War, the demand for steel grew. The work of the Vulcans was vital to the Union's war effort. But as the Civil War drew to a close, puddlers' wages were threatened. The Vulcans declared a national strike. The strike wore on for 8 months. Finally, the industry leaders agreed to the workers' demands. The Vulcans won wage increases tied to industry profits, as well as union recognition. With this victory, the Vulcans' membership grew. By 1873, the number of Vulcans had topped 3,000 members. Unfortunately, that year saw a major economic panic sweep across the United States. The economic crisis took a toll on union membership. Another downfall of the union was their policy not to admit black members. This meant that employers could hire black labor in an effort to undermine the union. By 1876, the Vulcans had merged with other steel unions to form the Amalgamated Association of Iron and Steel Workers. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As Costco and Sam's Club shoppers can attest, buying in bulk can save money. Now, a growing number of communities are taking the same approach to electricity. Typically, individual consumers buy electricity from a utility, but 9 states now have laws allowing what's known as community choice aggregation. This means local governments can buy energy in bulk on behalf of their citizens, while the utility continues to manage transmission. Customers can opt out. But John Farrell of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance says usually fewer than 10% of customers do. In part, that's because community choice programs often provide the same or lower rates.
And a secondary thing that is happening in most of the places where these programs are running is the purchase of more renewable energy.
For example, many programs in California and New York offer customers the option of buying 100% renewable electricity.
Community choice really represents a movement that we're seeing across the country of cities saying, we want to do more around climate and we want to do more around clean energy.
He says as these programs grow more common, they can help get more clean energy on the grid and save people money, too. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Everyone, hypocrites, better watch out. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Who sings Hypocrites? Oh, I wish they would watch out. I'm afraid
Jimmy
they're not.
Cliff, uh-huh. And I played that this morning because of all the just nonsense, hypocritical nonsense that the Republicans and I suppose Democrats too are spewing out. We don't have enough money to pay the federal workers. Well, how about all the money we're spending on the military
and
on ICE to deport people? We told people at the Mexican border seeking asylum, we don't have any room left in the United States to let people live? Seriously?
No, I know.
They're just lying.
Trust me, if they were refugees from Norway, he'd say yes.
Yeah.
All right. On that note, let's join Stefan Schmidt. He is known affectionately as Dr. Politics. He's a professor of political science at Iowa State. I have been doing this Dog and Pony Show with Stefan Schmidt for about maybe going on 20 years. And now that the caucus is over, now that the primary is over, Stefan, there is so much to sort of talk about as we sort of look moving forward. So I have not had a chance really to talk to you about your take on what happened in New Hampshire compared to Iowa. We had an enormous turnout. An enormous turnout. It beat all our records. We saw a winnowing of the field, no surprise. That did not really happen in Iowa. And I think the biggest story is coming out of New Hampshire. Bernie wins, Amy Klobuchar shows, and Biden disappears. That's my take on what happened. But I'm kind of curious as to your analysis.
Well, I am a refugee from the Iowa caucuses. Not on the Mexican border, but really what we had happen in Iowa, of course, was a collapse of the system. And I was very happy to see Iowa actually winnow the field from about 25 Democrats who started out and who chickened out and never came to Iowa. Mm-hmm. And so we ended up with something like 10 or 11. So we did winnow the field, Arnie, mm-hmm. and you winnowed the field a little more.
Mm-hmm.
But as everybody says, both of our states are small, they're white, they're, you know, not representative of the country. And so now, of course, we are asking ourselves, will the same candidates who did so well in Iowa and New Hampshire now also shine in Nevada and South Carolina,
right.
And then, of course, on Super Tuesday. And the answer is, I have no idea.
Yeah, no, it is very interesting because I know, for example, Bernie Sanders is going into Nevada, and yet the huge union in Nevada is sort of trashing Bernie Sanders because their claim is they don't want Medicare for all because they have spent so much time negotiating their health care plan. Why would he take what they've negotiated away from them? You know, this is what they spent all their earnest time and money. But you know what's really interesting to me when I hear that argument? I also hear, you know, the guys that are in those unions saying, but I had to give up my pay raise for that great health care plan. And I hate to break it to you, you know, how often do I get sick, but I can't afford the food on my table or the unaffordable apartment I need to live in? So it's, you know, if I'm not worrying about health care, maybe I'll get a bigger paycheck. This is what I just think is so interesting, is that the union bosses are so proud of, you know, showing what they're able to do with health care. And what I'm asking is, what about my paycheck?
Well, you know, it's all very complicated, Artie, because obviously, you know, Medicare for All has a price tag attached to it, as Joe Biden and others have said, that is enormous.
Mm-hmm.
And the argument that, well, we're going to take that away from the billionaires by raising their taxes is a good response. But, you know, you don't, as president, you have to have the House and you have to have the Senate vote on it.
I know.
And you don't just sign an executive order taking money away from the 1% or the trillionaires and putting it into health care. And so the question still remains, what is the support going to be for this in Texas? What is, you know, you did a great show on Texas just now. I don't think that Bernie Sanders and Medicare for All taking away people's private health insurance is going to probably sell very well in Texas.
I'm a little heartbroken about what happened to Elizabeth Warren as she started talking about Medicare for All. And it wasn't just what she was talking about when how would she pay for it, but she also talked about the transition. And as soon as she used the word transition, she was trashed. And the irony is that in Bernie's plan, there's a 4-year transition. And you know what? Bernie voted for the Affordable Care Act. Oh, it wasn't Medicare for All. He compromised his values. He sold out by voting for the Affordable Care Act. Come on, Bernie, grow up and teach people. You know, if you've got these group of supporters, yes, you want to see the healthcare system change. Yes, you want to see it improved. Yes, you want to see everyone covered. Yes, you believe it's a right. But when you look at it all over the world, it isn't just one flavor. It isn't just Medicare for All. There are at least 8 or 9 variations on a healthcare theme. All of it do it better. All of it do it cheaper. All of us have us more healthy. We have the worst system and not the best system. It's the best system for really rich people that even if we got rid of abortion, they can buy an abortion. Even if we didn't have the ability of Medicaid or Medicare, they wouldn't care because they could go to the finest doctors. That's not what healthcare is about. And I think that's the problem for Elizabeth, is that her honesty is what destroyed her. I actually really want Bernie to be a little more honest.
Well, that's interesting. And I would sort of disagree with you on Elizabeth Warren. I mean, I think I heard a lot of people say, she reminds me of a school teacher, a scolding school teacher, and she reminds me too much of Hillary Clinton. And so I think, you know, that played into it as well. She had too many different solutions to all the problems in this country, 8,000 different programs, and she waved her arms too much, Arnie. So I think she just burned out. She had her peak time, and then people got tired.
Oh, Stephen, isn't this
what a misogynist thing to say? I just want to remind you that was the most sexist thing I have ever heard. And understand, the lens you are putting her through is not the lens you'd put a boy through. So just realize what you did about the arms and the plans and the teacher and all this stuff. I can't wait till Amy Klobuchar really starts getting some attention. And how you start describing her as the scolding principal, the school marm, the woman that says, you can't have that. Slap your hand. I'm only giving you a piece of the pie, not half the pie. Understand how you're going to start describing Amy Klobuchar in the exact same way. But God forbid a boy says, I'm going to limit what you get, and then you're going to celebrate his intelligence and his ability to lead. Come on, Stefan.
And really, the only thing that Hillary Clinton and Elizabeth Warren have in common is that they're both female.
Come on.
You know, it's and how can you criticize the idea that there's so many problems in this country that I'm actually going to try to solve all of them? What, we're going to only solve one or two problems and let the rest of the fester for another 4, 8, 12 years?
And how well have the boys done? Let's be honest here. Come on, Stefan, I love you. I admire you. But how well have the men done? You know, and we see this sense of knowledge and authority and competence because you happen to have a penis. And I hate to break it to you. That's why we have climate change. That's why we have the huge gap between rich and poor. That's why Wall Street got bailed out and not the rest of us. I mean, let's understand what the boys have done. They haven't prioritized education. They haven't prioritized health care. They haven't prioritize climate change. And what is killing the planet today? Those are the things that are killing the planet. The boys won, and what did they deliver? Stefan, are you mad at me? Uh-oh. I think he's mad at me.
Did he hang up?
Stefan, did you disconnect? He may have disconnected.
He is disconnected.
He did disconnect.
I don't know if he did it on purpose.
All right, everyone. I love him. But it is sexist to say that. You know, and as a woman who ran for higher office, it is sexist to say that. You know, I mean, I understand. Look, there are things that bother me about Elizabeth Warren. There are things that bother me about Mayor Pete. But Stefan, listen to me. I don't want to lose you as a friend. But understand, you can't. The things that are being said are said only about girls. And having lived the life of a female politician, I know what it's like to be put through a different lens. I mean, Ken, when I ran, oh God, Stefan, please forgive me. I don't want to lose you. But what I want people to know is when I ran for governor, the first question I got, and it was from a female reporter, was, what about your children? And I looked at her and I almost started to cry, Ken. And I said, don't you realize I'm running for my children? It's not about what about my children. It's that I'm being a good mother. I'm being a good parent. I'm being a good leader. You run because it is so important that you protect the future. And the future are my children. I don't run to harm them. I run to protect them. You know, there's an expression that we used to talk about many, many years ago when I was doing gender politics. And the expression was that the men were good on the hard issues and the women were good on the soft issues. And what is perceived as the hard issues are sort of, you know, these sort of generic, the economy and tax policy and the military-industrial complex and that kind of thing. Those were the hard issues. And that women were good on the soft issues, education and healthcare and climate change and all those things that people frankly said didn't really matter, not as much as those hard issues. Well, I'm going to remind everyone that if you look at what is failing the planet today, it is the soft issues. It's coronavirus. That's a healthcare issue. That's a public health issue. We heard that with Glenn Smith, that that's going to be the thing that may undermine oil, coal, and gas. And what we're talking about is healthcare. What are we talking about our kids? Our kids are strapped with student debt, which is taking away their ability to dream and build the new company of the future and plan for the future. That's education, everyone. And then let's look at climate change. Climate change is undermining our ability. Look what happened to Houston and the floods. Look what's happening to Australia and the fires. Look what's happening to Miami going underwater. I mean, I'm not making it up, but Stefan, look what you're saying. It's been said to me. Maybe that's why I reacted so harshly, because I heard it said about me. And so, I don't know whether I'd have been a good leader, but I know I probably raise my voice and raise my arms and sound occasionally like a principal or a teacher or a professor. But there's nothing wrong with a principal, a teacher, a professor. That's what educates the future. That's how we got leaders today. They invested in the future. What is the great line from Kristen McAuliffe? The great line, everyone, of, oh, please, Stefan, I don't want to lose you. The great line of Kristen McAuliffe is, I touch the future, yeah. I teach.
Yeah.
Let me remind you, I touch the future, I teach.
So, Arnie, I love Stefan too, and I hope he comes back, and I trust that he will. He may have reacted to your jumping on him with such vehemence on the sexism issue.
I was harsh.
Well,
I agree.
Also, I felt the same way when he said she's like Hillary Clinton, because I don't see anything they have in common except that they're both women and they're running for president. But some of the other things that he said, and I don't feel this way about Elizabeth, but some of the things he said about her sounding too much like she's scolding like a professor or something like that. My wife and her sister and other women I know who are feminists and good, caring people and progressive-minded on all issues, not just women's issues, they say the same thing, that that's their concern about Elizabeth, is that when if she is the nominee, when she goes across the country, that that's the way she's going to come across and it's going to lose potential voters. So
what I'm trying to figure out is we all have our –
But that's exactly right. Right. Everyone
Beto
has that.
Beto waved his hands. Remember? Beto jumped on the tables. Remember everyone was saying? And yet he came in within 2 percentage points of Ted Cruz in Texas. And yet he still waves his arms. He waved his arms in Texas too.
Well, and Donald Trump raises his voice, raises his arms, yells and screams, says hateful things. And there's still millions of people who voted for him and who will again. And that doesn't necessarily mean that a candidate who does any of those things, obviously without the viciousness of Trump, but, you know, like Elizabeth Warren. So, okay, that's people's MO and they are who they are. And everybody has flaws. So we need to get past them. Amy's going to have flaws. Pete Buttigieg.
They are.
God knows Joe Biden and Mike Bloomberg, who has probably more flaws than most of the other Democrats combined. But everybody's going to have flaws. And I don't understand why, for instance, the Democratic Party leaders and other Democratic elected officials across the country are going crazy about, oh my gosh, if Bernie is the nominee and he's this declared socialist and he has these policies that are pretty progressive, almost as badly progressive as FDR – or LBJ's Great Society. I mean, that's essentially where they're coming from.
But
they go crazy over that. And what about the alternative? They're running against Donald Trump.
But that's a method of attack. So everyone, when you've heard me tell this story before, Ken. When I was running for Congress, basically what Charlie Bass did was turn Arnie Arneson into a gay Jewish communist. All right? Now, why could he do this? One, I'm aggressive. I hope I'm smart. And I take no prisoners. I'm willing to fight to the death. Okay? I'm willing to do that. And so in order to scare people, he had to frame me in such a way that he knew that with each word he used about me, gay, who is he frightening? Jew, who is he frightening? Communist or socialist, who is he frightening? Now, let me just share something with you. I am not gay, I am not a Jew, and I'm not a socialist. Did I tell people I'm not gay, I'm not a Jew, and I'm not a socialist? No. I just want you to know that. Why? Because I don't care about your sexual orientation. That's your life. That's who you are. I am not going to run away because someone assumes I'm a heterosexual or a homosexual. I know who I am, and I'm comfortable in my skin. I am not a Jew. But if you are going to basically accuse me or suggest that because somehow that's the card you want to play, then I don't want your anti-Semitic vote. Because I will walk with them. I will die with them. I am not a socialist. I was raised in a capitalist household. My background is in corporate and securities law work. Ready for that one, everyone? And I said, but you know what? There are aspects of socialism that I value. So understand that kind of labeling happens all the time. What I'm asking people to do is look at the policy prescriptions that people are offering. And you've heard me say this before. It was hard to vote for Elizabeth Warren. And the reason why it was hard to vote for Elizabeth Warren wasn't because of her flailing arms. You know why it was hard? Because I don't think she has great political instincts. And in the end, it is not about policy. It is not about organization. It is also about your ability to pivot and have political instincts. And sadly, especially now, more than ever, that skill set is crucial. That's, and she, I'm telling you right now, the reason why you saw her numbers drop and her inability to be able to sort of figure it out, she had time to move beyond Pocahontas. She had the time. She doesn't have time anymore. Now it's a sprint. And in a sprint, those political skills are absolutely crucial. The question is, how come she didn't jump out first where Amy Klobuchar jumped out first after the Iowa caucus? She came in fifth, and she was the first one in front of the national media. Think about what she did during the debate. She took more time than Elizabeth and had fewer questions. All those things are not only about being a good leader, it's understanding how to play the political game.
So it's interesting to me because you said a moment ago that voters should look at the policy prescriptions of who they're voting for. But with Elizabeth, you agree with her on the policy prescriptions, as do I, and think that that's really what you'd like to see for policy enacted. But the reason you had trouble voting for her is not because of her policies, but rather because of her political skills.
Because this is politics.
I'm not
going to school with Elizabeth Warren. I'm not reading her book. I am electing her president. Please understand that. And a president is not just smart. A president is not just articulate. A president is not just those political skills. A president, this is a job that requires, it's a hydra.
Yeah,
it has lots of different heads. And if you're really weak in that one aspect, it ends up hurting you. And the gift of a Barack Obama, for example, was that a Barack Obama, at least in 2008, packages the hope. All right.
Yeah.
Remember,
yeah.
Had the political skills, was articulate, knew how to do the organization. He was able to blend enough of the package together to make it possible for him to defeat a Hillary Clinton, of all people, who've been doing this forever, and win in a general election twice.
Right.
That is a very, very challenging thing.
But let me suggest, though, that there's two parts of what you said about you have to not only have policies but be president. One is getting elected president, and the other is governing after you become president. And I think that what you're focused on, the weakness of Elizabeth that you've articulated, is that she might not get elected president, which of course means you never get a chance to put your policies into place or to lead. But the question I ask you is, if you look only at the political skills, you elect an Amy Klobuchar, for example, she may not have the ability that Elizabeth has to explain in a longer explication, not just a one-minute soundbite in a debate, but really get into a discussion and also to put in policies, because after all, you do want somebody who's going to put in your policies.
But you're asking me to embrace someone who can't even physically get there.
Right,
and you're talking about the governing. Nobody knows how well you govern until you govern. Let me just say,
My dad. Harry Truman.
My dad said to me, nobody will ever know what kind of governor you will be because you've never had to sit in that seat and make those decisions and make those appointments and then begin to triage as you have to figure out what you sacrifice and what you embrace. And until you actually have to govern, nobody knows. Look what people thought about Donald Trump. A lot of people didn't realize that he would turn into a tyrant. What they were hoping that he would do is sort of a variation on Ronald Reagan, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
And what they got instead was basically a despot and a tyrant. He went to a place, but we didn't know because he had never governed. We didn't know because he had never been an elected official. We didn't know because people were looking at somehow Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump and actually had the chutzpah to say it was between Tweedledee and Tweedledum. It was not.
Yeah.
It was not. But that's what happened.
But, you know, even within the narrow realm of getting yourself elected, it's one thing to look now at, oh my gosh, which of the Democrats look like they're more likely to be electable? But when one of them gets the nomination, whether it's Bernie Sanders or Tulsi Gabbard, for God's sake, the alternative is Trump. And so the question
is,
can
Glenn.
They run and beat Trump?
Right. And you heard that from Glenn when Glenn basically said that the African-American community is looking at Michael Bloomberg's record of stop and frisk and some of his racial animus, frankly, and they're looking at Donald Trump. And here's what they're doing. They're saying we can have a guy who, when it comes to how anti-African-American, what a racist he is, Donald Trump is at 100, all right? Michael Bloomberg is maybe at 65. And you're asking me, and everybody else on the Democratic field is probably a 10 or 2 or 0. Mm-hmm. But if it turns out I'm ending up with a choice between a Michael Bloomberg and a Donald Trump, I'll take 65.
Right, why wouldn't most of the voters, if it comes down to the general election, why wouldn't they take Elizabeth Warren over Donald Trump?
I'm not disagreeing with you, but if she can't get the nomination, it isn't a choice.
Yeah, and all I'm saying is when we nominate a president, when we vote in primaries and choose a nominee, we should think about other things other than just can they win, but also what happens when they do win.
All right, our last song is?
Our last song is When the Swamp Gets Drained, which hopefully will be soon. It's the government corruption theme song.
When the swamp gets drained in the broad daylight, watch the vile little vermin as he's slithering and squirming, trying to get out of sight. When the tide goes out and it's all laid bare, they'll be slipping and sliding, trying to find a hole to hide, but there's no hole there. When the first one squeals, swamp